me kick and scream.
You know, Tim, you may not realize this, but I have wanted Rob Mathis on my show for 12 years.
12 years?
12 years.
How old is this show?
13 years.
Okay, so what were you doing for the other year?
I didn't know about Rob before
okay,
that.
There we go. All right,
sorry.
So.
Geez. Rob Mathis, Emmy-winning, Grammy, Tony, Drama Desk nominated.
Drama. Oh,
arranger, composer, music producer, director, singer, songwriter. This guy, I don't know. What else do you say other than, what do we got, four paragraphs of bio? I couldn't cut his bio down. This is the biggest name-dropping bio I have ever seen in my life.
It's incredible. It's mind-blowing, the people that he's worked with.
He's worked with everyone. Do we start? Do we even dare do that? Elton John, Tony Bennett, Celine Dion, Tim McGraw, Lou Reed, Mavis Staples, Jay-Z, Lenny Kravitz, Sade, Eric Clapton, Avril Lavigne, Beck, Aretha Franklin, Hall & Oates, Harry Connick Jr. I mean, and a British guy named Gordon is all we know,
yes.
Right? That's the
yes,
main reason.
Not allowed to mention his name.
Can't say his real name. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Rob Mathis. Sir, thank you for your time. I really appreciate you helping me with my bucket list and coming on the show.
12 years.
Dude, 12 years.
Wow, that's extraordinary.
I worked.
What did I do 12 years ago that made you want to actually speak with me?
A lady named Kathy Lee Gifford gave me your CD.
Oh, she's a sweetie.
Yeah, but I don't want to talk about her. I don't want to talk. I want to know this, right? Here we go. We're going to start this interview right now. Who said this, Rob? All creativity comes from somewhere else. We're all using a common language. It is what we do with those common building blocks that separates the real artists from the imitators. The best artists ingest things and make great fecal matter out of those things. They digest it and make something new, the real fecal matter. The worst artists never digest it. They just puke it up, regurgitating language, and inevitably end up sounding like someone else. Who said that?
The first two sentences, maybe three sentences, are Sting. And the last three sentences are a paraphrase. Both are kind of a paraphrase of Peter Gabriel.
Oh.
Talking with me about this this Zeppelin case that I was part of. And I agree with every word they said.
Me too. That's why when I read that on your Facebook page, I said, okay, we're starting with that. That was just fantastic.
Wow.
Well, you know, it's interesting for me. I mean, when I was in L.A. with these poor attorneys that were just reading transcripts all day long and fighting about it, you know, and fighting this tough battle, I was thinking to myself, really? Really? And I think part of what happened is that the Blurred Lines case is the first real precedent where people started to feel like they could sue for sonic similarity. Now, I think I'm slightly wrong on this because I think the Zeppelin lawsuit was before the Blurred Lines. But there's been so much focus on the suit, I think, partially because of the Blurred Lines case with the Marvin Gaye family suing Robin Thicke,
right.
and Pharrell. And I do think the Marvin Gaye family has a point. I mean, I think they think clearly you listened to this Marvin Gaye song. But the riposte to that and the reason they're appealing that case is if you go down the road of sonic similarity,
oh, yeah.
There's going to be no time in the courts for criminal cases. Because people will be suing each other forever. I mean, think about Zeppelin. A Zeppelin could then be sued by any number of blues people, and they have been, but then they could start suing everyone that came after them. Every rock band that came after Zeppelin was influenced by Zeppelin. Zeppelin would be suing AC/DC, and Michael McDonald would go back and sue Robbie Dupree for whatever that hit was that ripped off What a Fool Believes, and Sting and Andy Summer, they could sue everybody who used a chorused guitar after the Police, you know. So it just gets really wacky. And the problem is this, you know, there's this YouTube aha video that everyone watches, and they listen to the front of Stairway, and they listen to Taurus, and they go, wow, that sounds super similar. And, of course, you know, I grew up playing My Funny Valentine in A minor, which is, you're not going to be able to hear this because I'm on the phone, but it's, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the same chord progression. If you play My Funny Valentine in A minor and you put it on top of Taurus and Stairway, it sounds like a nice record.
Wow.
Because it's the same key, it's the same chords. And it's also the chords from Time in a Bottle and To Catch a Shad and Cry Me a River and Dido's Lament by Purcell. So sonic similarity is a bitch. You got all these people going, I don't know, man. I don't know. They stole it. Dude, Stairway to Heaven's 8 minutes long. There are seven verses. Taurus is this little 2-minute and 38-second instrumental. It's sweet enough, but I don't want to be mean, Drew.
Mm-hmm.
But when I first listened to Taurus to see if I wanted to take this case on, when they called me to be a part of it, I listened to it and I was like, really? Why would anyone want to steal that? I mean, it's fine. Yeah. It's nice enough, but that would be the exact opposite of anything I would want to steal. I mean, it's fine, but it's a 2-minute and 30-second trifle, and Stairway is like the rock epic of history. There is no vocal in Taurus. There isn't really even a melody to speak of. There's a little twinkly harpsichord thing. So all these people are like, man, Page stole it, man. It's been known for a long time. It's crap. It's not true.
Oh, man. How do you feel now? Do you feel better? That was insane. What I want to know is, have you ever come across Seth Lichtenstein or Ken Hertz? Those are two attorneys. Well, Ken is my attorney that I work with down there. They're sort of big music attorneys. And I think they've been studying this case. I don't know if they've been involved, but are those names, have you come across them at all? Ken Hertz?
They're not. I do not know them, Drew. But again, I've never served on a case before. It's my first time ever in a courtroom.
So,
except going for jury duty.
Yeah. I want to introduce you to my cohort here. We affectionately call him Tim the Tool because of the amount of mistakes he makes every show.
Yep.
Tim, this is Rob, and you guys have something in common. I want to go there right now. You ready?
Yes.
Well, Tim, you're about to kind of screw up your son's
graduation
because you got to go see Peter Gabriel and Sting.
Yes.
Rob.
Wow.
Yeah. Tell them your story.
Well, I went on the stand for the Zeppelin case on Friday at 3:40, and this judge is tough. And at 4 o'clock, he's like, we're done. And I was in the middle of my testimony. And basically, I went to the lawyer, said, please, please get the judge. I got to be home on Tuesday. You know, and our lawyer was fantastic and asked the other lawyer, if there's any way they could delay my testimony till Wednesday or whatever, and basically everyone said, no, we can't hold this trial up any longer. You've got to stay in the state, and you got to testify on Tuesday. So I missed my daughter's graduation from high school.
Buddy.
Those musicians messing up everybody's lives.
Yeah, but Tim's quite a musician himself. Tim, you're probably more excited to have Rob Mathis on the show
kidding?
Than I am.
Oh, my goodness. Just three of my big sort of, you know, I guess the teenage, early adult years are often your sort of prime becoming a musician, music likes, whatever. And three of my big people are Gabriel, Sting, and U2. And I see those all over your little bio here, and I'm quite jealous.
Yeah, he's giddy. So let's go back to 1984, okay? Let's just do a little time machine thing here. Graduating Berklee School of Music.
Wow.
Didn't graduate.
Well, yeah, sorry.
2 years.
You were 2 years, and then you bailed. And actually, didn't you kind of bail after 1 year and go back and then go? You were all over the place, man. And you were going to get into this band, and they wanted to sign it. You have to sign a 10-year contract or something, and I don't know. Crazy life.
You know everything. My wife doesn't know that story. Where did you find all this? Amazing.
All I know is that I don't know if he's still artist in residence, but the real musician in the Taylor family. See, that's my guy, is James. Livingston Taylor. Livingston was, I believe, artist in residence at Berklee for
Yeah, and my daughter went to the summer thing, the summer course, and just adored him. He's a fantastic educator. He's really great.
You know, when I was a kid, Rob, my mom made me take piano lessons. Royal Conservatory kind of stuff, right? But it was the Thompson piano books that were way cooler, except I didn't actually learn how to read the music. I'd remember how my piano teacher played it and then kind of figure it out based on that.
I did virtually the same thing with the John Thompson book, and my mother finally caught me when I was about six and said, what are you... You know, because it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5s right there on the C. I didn't, wasn't reading the notes. I was just listening to her play it, and I got caught and scolded. And then I learned how to read.
Well, I got caught and scolded when I was playing my Kiss album really loud, and I lived in a funeral home, and it didn't go over well upstairs. You know what I mean?
Oh, that's funny.
You don't want God of Thunder playing while your grandmother's being buried.
Beth, what can I do?
Oh, yeah.
Beth,
yeah, that's true. Love Gun. You don't want to be playing.
So, but if I understand this right, Rob, it wasn't Beethoven's fifth that transformed you. It was Mahler's sixth. True story?
Mahler's sixth. And I looked, you know the story, I think, but for your audience, I was at Berklee College of Music, was a total jazzer. My parents' classical music, I didn't want to hear about it, even though I had to play Beethoven when I was a kid. And I went to the tape library. You turn in a catalog number, they give you what you want. I turned in John Coltrane's Impressions, I believe, and they gave me Mahler 6. Then, of course, it didn't have a cover on it. It was just a tape. So I went to the thing, I put it on, and I heard gong, gong, zom, sa-da-da. And I was like, what the hell is this? It's certainly not John Coltrane. And I was just about to bring it back, and I was just transfixed because I'd never heard Mahler before. I'd heard Beethoven, Chopin, Mendelssohn, Mozart, Bach my whole life, and the harmonies, the rich harmonies. And I just sat there and listened to the whole symphony. It's 90 minutes long. And I decided I've got to learn how to do this because this is a time when Wynton Marsalis was becoming really, really big, and he's a hero too. But at that time, he would preach to the students, you know, jazz is really the only American music, and symphonies just play our museum pieces and all that stuff. And he's not as militant as he used to be, but here I am, this white kid at Berklee College of Music, trying to burn through the Charlie Parker Omni book and playing John Coltrane solos. And when I heard Mahler, I was like, you know what? I think this is closer to my heart, learning how to write for orchestra and doing that kind of stuff, than trying to be a true jazz guitar head, you know? That's why I eventually left Berklee and went to study with a classical guy.
Crazy, crazy. So is this thing that you have, this illness, is it genetic? I mean, your daughter's certainly got, you know, whatever you got, and both of your parents, your mother's twin sister, her husband all studied music at Yale, your mother's consistently taught between 50 and 60 piano students for the last 50 years, your dad was a clarinetist, your Aunt Joyce played bassoon with the New York City Opera, and her husband studied composition with Paul Hindemith and played trombone in big bands and wrote arrangements, and one of your grandfathers was a songwriter. So, dude, it's genetic, right?
Well, you know, genetic, I guess so to a certain extent, but then you have these music geniuses that come from parents that aren't musical at all. You know, like Sting's mother played a little piano, but his dad wasn't musical. None of his brothers were. Beethoven's dad was musical, but you know, Stravinsky's dad was a bass in the Russian opera, and so there's evidence of some genetics, you know, and obviously the Bach family, but I don't know, man. I mean, it's, you know, you grow up and music's everywhere, and your mother's playing, teaching piano students while you're in the womb. It's got to have some effect on it, you know.
Emma, Sarah, and
Lily.
Are they all musical? Or is there one of them that's just useless?
No, they're all very musical. You know, because I you know, live and breathe music, I don't know whether any of them are going to go into music full time. Sarah's going to go to Berklee College of Music. She's excited about it. She has a beautiful voice. She wants to be a writer. But she's not sure. She may want to go into the music business. She may, you know, as opposed to being an artist. But they've all got the bug to a certain extent.
Yeah. Was you being the music guy that you are, was that a chick magnet? Like, is that what won Tammy over? Was that it?
You know what? I was the furthest thing in the world
from a chick magnet.
Oh my gosh! I was always 20 pounds overweight. Looked like, you know, I might run a deli when I was older. I mean, pleasant looking. Certainly when you dress me up in a suit, I'm handsome enough. But no, the furthest thing from a chick magnet. And I had a huge crush on my wife, Tammy, when she was young and wisely. She wanted nothing to do with me at all.
So what did it?
Well, I do think, you know, it's true, Drew. Finally, when she became interested, she saw me live at a couple of clubs, and I had a great band at that time.
See?
And we started talking, and she was dating some jerk,
yep.
You know,
yep.
Really a jerk,
yep.
and didn't treat her right. And I was like, what are you doing with him, you know? Mm. And the rest is history. I've been with her more years than I've been without her in my life. So,
you won't be offended if I say something like, dude, you married up.
Oh, I married hugely up.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an understatement.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Married up.
Just want to clear that up right there.
Yes. Yeah.
Rob Mathis on the phone. He's probably the only guy I know who goes into heat every Christmas.
I do. I'm a Christmas fanatic. I love Christmas.
How was the Christmas concert this past year, and what's coming up this year? Tim, this guy puts on the Christmas concerts to end Christmas concerts.
Okay. Tell me.
Well, you know, I've always written little song cycles around the holiday and played them in my church. And the, you know, the whole story of innocence coming into the world, not as a big, angry kind of atom bomb of truth, but a baby in the manger. That story just always blew me away. Hmm. And the truth behind how, you know, love can truly change the world. There's so many things that can be written from that story that I just have always written around Christmas. I mean, and I've always used that phrase, I go into heat around when I first smell the first smoke coming from chimneys around Thanksgiving time. And, you know, I spend my life watering other people's gardens. I mean, part of the reason, you know, my resume sounds like such a name-dropping fiesta is because for all those names you read, people need arrangements on things. They need strings on something. They need horns on something. Can you do an orchestral arrangement of this? Can you, you know, the thing I did for Bono last year, they were doing a one charity concert for his charity thing at Carnegie Hall, and they needed someone to write the arrangements and conduct the orchestra. So, I'll do that for him, and then there are a bunch of stars that come in and sing. And so technically, I write arrangements for all these people, and I'm able to put them on my resume, and makes me look good at the local town hall. when you water other people's gardens all year long, mm-hmm. it's really wonderful to just have a festival of light around the music you write for yourself, where you can be an artist, and I can be an artist for 3 nights, write all these kind of Ellingtonian horn arrangements based around carols and bring out all the songs I'd written in the past around the holiday and just be able to perform my stuff for 3 nights. And we've got, you know, Will Lee from the old Letterman Show on bass and Sean Pelton from Saturday Night Live on drums, a bunch of horn players from the Paul Simon Band and three guys that went out with the Stones. And so I have this world-class band, and we just rock, man. It is just great. It's the three best nights of my year, every year, you know?
I still think Steely Dan should have recorded the first version of Christ Came Back and trashed the cathedral.
Oh, did you actually hear that version? Have you heard that version? Or you just heard me describing that version?
Don't wreck a good story with facts, man. Come on.
Yeah, that song is available on iTunes, I believe, and that's one of my proud ones.
Christ Came Back and Trashed the Cathedral. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
Your Christmas show is, you know, also a bit of a multi-faith thing, right? And I got to know, other than Rabbi Mark Golub, who else inspires you spiritually?
Well, you know, as you grow older and you read as much as you can, you know, you go from reading scripture, reading Kierkegaard, and you have, you know, you meet various people, and I will just never forget at the end of the biggest Christmas concert we ever gave, which is over a decade ago, with Vanessa Williams and Michael McDonald and David Sanborn and the great African-American activist and actor Ossie Davis reading Langston Hughes poems. It was kind of the big kahuna of my Christmas concerts. after that, at the end of that night, all the artists wanted to repeat their songs because we were filming it for PBS. And they're all so picky. Once David Sanborn said, "Can I get another take of that?" And I turned to the audience and said, "Can we do another one of those?" And they're like, "Yeah, yeah, yeah." Well, at about 11:45 at night, when these artists want to kind of do another take, yeah, the audience was not going, "Yeah, yeah, yeah." They're more like, "Okay." Anyway. But so we do the final song. I go off. And I come back on to do the encore, and everyone's just kind of tired. They're great, but they were kind of tired. And we're done, and we're like, "Good night! It's over!" Rabbi Mark Golub stands up from Stamford, Connecticut. He stands up. He goes, "No! I want more!" I'm like, "Rabbi, it's 11:45, and this is like a concert. There's a lot of songs about the manger."
Yeah.
And
yeah,
here's a rabbi standing up going, "I want more." So I said, "Okay, all right. I gotta go to this guy's house and hear everything about Hanukkah." And so I went to his house, and I've been writing him songs around the Festival of Lights every year. And they're some of the best songs I've written for that show. Huh. So he's been a huge inspiration. There's a poet named Philip Levine. I think he was kind of agnostic in his religious practice, but his poetry kills me. He died Valentine's Day 2015, and he writes about the nobility and the grace of the working man, and it's so moving. It's become kind of my secular scripture. So, you know, I'm a reader, and I stay in touch with all sorts of different things on this walk, so to speak. And so I get spirituality, terrible word, misused a lot, but I get it from various corners.
Sure, sure. Okay, what if Rob Mathis had grown up in the hood? Like, you grew up pretty much in Greenwich, didn't you?
You know what? The truth of the matter is I did not grow up in an upper-class home. My parents were workers. Okay. This was Greenwich, Connecticut. Used to be a place. We lived in Old Greenwich. Used to be a place where if you were a teacher, you could live there. I mean, there was backcountry Greenwich, which was where Donald Trump lived. And you know, the Gettys and all those kind of people. But downtown, you know, Old Greenwich and Coscob, you could be a school teacher and live there. It's not that way anymore.
No.
It is now hedge fund capital of the universe.
Yep.
But my parents lived on the edge of Stamford, Connecticut. My dad was a band teacher, and my mom was a piano teacher. And I still remember driving down 95 and knowing the quarter toll was coming, and my dad going off the exit to take whatever local road, skip the toll because he didn't have a quarter.
Wow. Wow.
So I definitely didn't grow up an upper class kid, but I did not grow up in the hood.
Okay. All right. Well, I mean, I don't know. I just have this feeling that when you're working out most of your music, that you work on some sort of, you know, just an upright piano, not some massive Steinway. True story?
Oh, definitely. Upright piano right here. I'm sitting right next to it.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. 'Cause you don't.
My ultimate musical hero used an out of tune upright piano his whole life. For Stravinsky, he wrote The Rite of Spring, one of the greatest documents of human history, artistic documents, on a bad out of tune upright piano.
Man,
I mean, that is like musical scripture. That's like the book of Ephesians of music.
Nice. What is the difference between David Foster and Phil Ramone?
Oh, that's a great question. I do love both of them. I mean, David Foster gets a bad rap, way too bad a rap, I think, actually, because his music is so refined and kind of people would call it slick. Mm-hmm. But let me tell you about David Foster. I don't want to become the big defender of David Foster because, you know, I would probably rather listen to Blind Willie McTell than a lot of David Foster-produced records.
Right.
He is a master. I mean, he's a great piano player. He's a great arranger. He's a very good singer. And I would go in, he would ask me to do a string arrangement for something, and I would go in and I would do the string arrangement. And then he'd say, can you come into the booth? And Phil was could kind of do this, but David was insane because he was a pianist. Phil used to be a prodigy violinist when he was young, but then he stopped playing. So for many years, he was just a producer. But David still plays the piano and is involved as a musician on all his records. I went into the booth, and David would take my score, and he'd go, bar 14, can you take that up the octave? In bar 30, I want to tacit the strings there. Just keep them out for a couple bars, Rob. I love what you wrote. It was lovely, but we need some space. And he would go through the entire thing after one listening of my string chart.
Wow.
And make about six edits, send me back in, and we were done. It was the most, surgical yet musical and artistic production, on the fly that I'd ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of like that on my own things now. I mean, you can't be a producer and be precious about what you write. So I'll be on sessions where I'm doing a string arrangement. I go, ah, that's terrible. Stop and tacit that. Oh, Rob, what were you thinking when you wrote that? Phil Ramone. So David was more of a hands-on guy. He did write the arrangements a lot of the time, and he played. Phil Ramone didn't. Phil Ramone was a producer in the old style of production, the kind of supervisor of everything.
Mm-hmm.
He was the last opinion, and he would be a great casting director. Okay, I've got this project for Natalie Cole, this project for Billy Joel, this project for Tony Bennett. Who do I hire for this record? I know exactly, and he would be the casting director. He would bring the perfect team together to play and arrange the project, and then in the end, he's the arbiter of everything. What do you think of that, Phil? Well, I don't know. So that's a producer in
right.
a way. Whereas David Foster is almost more like a film director in that he's got his hands in the dirt on every level.
Right.
Phil did too, but he's more a supervisor.
Is it true that Phil Ramone was the one who recorded Marilyn Monroe's intoxicated version of Happy Birthday, Mr. President to JFK? That's what I heard.
Absolutely. Phil's worked with everybody.
Wow.
Phil's worked with Frank Sinatra, Bob Dylan, Billy Joel. I mean, Phil, God rest his soul.
Yeah.
Phil's gone.
3 years ago, I think, did he not? Passed 3 years ago?
Yeah. And if it weren't for Phil, I mean, as good as I am at my best, if it weren't for Phil, I'd be working at Barnes & Noble.
Yeah.
And that's a good job, by the way. I love Barnes & Noble.
Yeah.
I would love to hang there all day. But Phil gave me, the biggest breaks in my career. I mean, I got to give credit to Vanessa Williams, too, early on.
Okay, pick one or add another. Little game we're playing on the Drew Marshall Show. Pick one or add another. Are you ready?
I think so.
Playing piano for Al Green when he sang Amazing Grace for the 9/11 tribute in 2002. Playing piano and leading the band for Bono and The Edge on their version of Cole Porter's Night and Day for Bono's Music Cares tribute. Mm. Remember, we're playing pick one or add another. Playing rhythm guitar for Eric Clapton on Stormy Monday. Playing for Elton John on I Guess That's Why They Call It the Blues.
Mm.
Arranging and playing It's a Man's World for James Brown and Pavarotti.
Yeah,
pick one or add another.
Pick one or add another. I'll add another.
oh, man.
You're sick.
I'll add two. This because you're talking about experiences that were like when I was in the middle of them. I was like, really? What did I do to deserve this?
Yeah.
Two of them come to mind. Sting. Sting's manager called me to see if I'd be interested in helping do his orchestral record, and I said, "Well, Sting's been a hero of mine for years, so yes." But I do not want to do synth demos.
Yeah.
I will go at my own expense. I will buy my plane ticket. I will pay for my hotel room. I will write the arrangement for free if you can give me a small orchestra in London and pay the studio and musician's cost. And I promise the arrangements will be good. I'll go over them with Sting. I'd rather just go record them to show them what I can do. And thank God for Kathy Shanker and Sting. They both were like, I like your spirit, kid. Okay.
I like your spunk.
So I went to Abbey Road and I did an arrangement of Roxanne, among others, King of Pain, and I think every little thing she does is magic. I brought it back, and Sting came down to hear it at the studio, and he just came down to hear it. We played it, and he's like, "Oh man, I love it! I want to sing on it now." Really?
Wow.
Yeah. So he goes into the booth, and they put the mic up, and I'm the only guy with the engineer in there, and he starts singing Roxanne on my orchestral arrangement of Roxanne.
That's cool.
And then he turns to me and he goes, "How is that? How is that? Was that in tune? I thought it was." And this is Sting asking me to kind of produce his vocal on Roxanne, and I'm thinking, "Oh my Lord in heaven!" And then the second one is, I did at this Bono concert I told you about at Carnegie Hall. I did a version of "I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For," which is one of my favorite songs ever written.
Yeah,
and I said, you know, I'm going to take Edge's guitar part, that famous guitar part, and I'm going to write a Copeland-esque kind of open fifths Americana version of it that just kind of is a pool of sound, and then ask if Edge can come in and we don't bring any rhythm in and just have Bono do the verse over that. And they were so nice. Edge and Bono were so kind. I turned to them and I said, guys, you don't have to do this. I just want you to hear it once. They're like, sure, man, we're into it. So I play the orchestration I did of Edge's guitar line. And Bono says, oh, man, that's it. Let's just start with that. You should start with that, and then we'll have Edge come in. And so, you know, a day later, we finished the concert with this.
Wow.
And I swear it was all I could do from burst into hysterical tears.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm on the Carnegie Hall stage where I saw Leonard Bernstein conduct Mahler's Ninth. And I'm conducting, and behind me is Bono, comes in with, I have climbed highest. I mean.
were you wearing Depends? Hey?
Yeah, I should have.
Yeah.
I should have been. I certainly got the suit cleaned the next day.
Yeah. Shoot. You know, Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For, I think, is the best song to walk down the aisle at your wedding to.
Oh, boy, that's good.
I don't even know how to formulate this question, but there seems to be a correlation between soul-bending music and the soul of the person who's bending the music. In other words, the stuff that permeates seems to have deeper stuff behind it. I think it was Dylan who was asked, he keeps getting asked time and time again about those prolific years where he wrote all these incredible songs, and he still sort of says something like, you probably know this better, like, I don't know, man, I was just a vessel. Do you believe in this vessel theory?
You know, it's difficult to ask a person like me, because I do see those great creators as being different creatures. Like, as good as my work is, and I have a lot of range, I mean, I don't think there are a lot of people that can kind of play the guitar and arrange the orchestra and write songs. I have a good range. There are a couple of us out there that kind of are, just have a bunch of things in our wheelhouse. Mm-hmm. But then there are people that are really struck with true brilliance. You know, Sting, Bono, Bruce Springsteen, Dylan, Lou Reed, David Byrne, you know, Tori Amos, Joni Mitchell. And those people write, create things that change our lives, change the world's dialect with music. And so I would think it's absolutely true. When they're in that zone... You know, when you're in the zone of creating, all I know for myself is if I'm in the zone of creating something truly deep, mm-hmm. that I'm really proud of, you are kind of possessed.
Well, okay, this goes directly to my real question, which is what we'll finish on. Boy, that time went fast. Rob, what the heck? It seems to me that on my show over the last 13 years, recording artists are more apt to say yes to coming on the Drew Marshall Show because they're okay talking about spiritual stuff versus actors. Why do you think that is?
Well, because music is the ineffable kind of... I mean, music is... Talking about music is like dancing about architecture, Woody Allen said. It's such a wonderful thing to try to get around. There's something so spiritual about it. It's something... You know, when I've become in the darkest moments in life, I still say, "Nah, Beethoven's Ninth is not an accident. I'm sorry." I, you know, Richard Dawkins, I know you're a really smart guy, man. I respect you tremendously. I know that religious fundamentalism is super scary, but Beethoven's Ninth is not an accident, man. There's a glory and a purpose behind the greatest art, and especially music, which speaks of something that can't be spoken, you know, that can't be truly communicated except through music.
Wow. Wow. Really, really well said. Ah, dude, that was worth the wait. I'm telling you. That was like jonesing for a Big Mac, you know? That was just... so good. Well, your latest release, Wheelbarrow, coming out when?
It should be on iTunes in about a month and a half, and I'm really proud of it, so I hope people can hang on and look for it. Wheelbarrow, Rob Mathis, Wheelbarrow.
Rob, I appreciate your guts. I love how you do life, how you do music, how you do God. Don't screw it up, man.
Oh, I'm guaranteed to screw it up. But I'll keep doing my best.
Rob, thank you so, so much. I'm just very appreciative.
Great.
Yeah, enjoyed it so much. Take care, man.
All right, see you, and see you, Tim.
Bye now.
That's the Drew Marshall Show. Thanks for tuning in, and may you find the God that sees you. The bigger love I am.